Tugalia for her introductory overview, and then I'll introduce Dr. Talhami and ask him to respond to those comments and perhaps give us a wider regional lens. So, Galia, the floor is yours.
Fine, thank you. Well, to say something positive, certainly there was a move forward for Netanyahu. The fact is that he did indeed say Palestinian state, and he did indeed talk about a Palestinian state next to the State of Israel. The words that he'd been unwilling to say before, the two-state solution. And it is a step forward, certainly, for him and for the Likud. It was done once before by a Likud prime minister, by Sharon, but it does have significance. It does have significance. It's a confirmation of the end, the death knell for the greater Israel idea. And while that was there before with Sharon, I think that it was very significant that Netanyahu, leading a very right-wing government, did find it necessary to say those words. And his implication actually all week has been that there are certain circumstances that can't be ignored. These are realities, and this bitter pill, as he would have put it, I think, has to be accepted. Having said that, my own reaction to the speech was slightly different, because what's of importance to me is not if Netanyahu made a step forward, but if in fact he made a step towards peace, or if we are any closer to resolving the conflict, because what is important to me is resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict, and particularly the conflict with the Palestinians. And here I'm a little less optimistic, because basically, I think what happened here is that Netanyahu said the words that he had to say, and in saying them, he did two things. One is he sought to placate President Obama and the pressure from abroad, and on the other hand, actually create a situation in which he has opposition from the right wing of a nature that he can say in the future, well, I'm under pressure, I can't go any further. But at the kind of opposition that is not going to be too difficult for him to handle. I'll put it in a different sense. The right wing in his government is not going to leave. They are not going to leave the coalition. They were upset because he said the words Palestinian state, but the way in which he said it led them to believe that this is not the point at which they have to leave the government. This is not a crossroads. And even though, of course, it is significant that he said it, it's not a crossroads. Because he said it in a way that is very much reminiscent of past prime ministers who tried to avoid reaching an agreement. He said it in a way that a Palestinian state would be demilitarized. Well, that's generally accepted, and that's been brought up in many of the talks that have taken place in the past in Camp David and after. Demilitarization is not the problem. The problem is all the other caveats that he puts on the nature of a Palestinian state that would be created. And the way in which I think he presented the whole history of the conflict in a particularly one-sided way in which there was no acknowledgement whatsoever of the fact that the Palestinians were deprived of something. And he used a number of arguments that we've heard before, that he himself has used before. But the most important point is that in talking about the future and what he wants to do or plans to do, he presented a picture with so many conditions and so many demands and so many reservations that there isn't really a Palestinian around who could accept it. So what we wind up having, and I think in this sense he was very very clever and very very intelligent from his point of view in his presentation. Because he presented the picture as if he was being totally generous and taking that step to talk about a Palestinian state. And therefore, now the ball is in the Palestinians' court, and it's for them to take it or leave it. But what he offered them is something that no Palestinian could take, because what he offered is a state without any sovereignty, without any control of its borders, without real sovereignty. And they will undoubtedly reject it, and certainly they've made comments to that in that direction already. He can, of course, say, well, no, I took the fatal step. I risked my right-wing supporters. I risked my government, and I'm offering peace. To be quite frank, I'm afraid that we're not a step further. I think we are very much back where we were before Olmert, before Sharon. I think we're back at a step that's closer to Shamir that says, okay, let's have talks, we'll stretch them out, we'll say some nice things, but we won't move forward. I must admit that I frankly am greatly disappointed and somewhat pessimistic as a result of the speech. I think the other point that we should make is that whether or not people buy it, I can tell you quite frankly that many people in Israel look at the fact that he said, that Netanyahu said a Palestinian state and said, ah, this is an enormous step forward. Now let's let the Palestinians show us that they will stop incitement. They will, and these are the things Netanyahu asked for, that they will behave as if there's no occupation, and then maybe we can talk. Because that was the bottom line of Netanyahu. Stop incitement, stop saying nasty things about Israel, stop trying to change things. And if we can see that you can govern well, you can control things, then maybe we can reach some kind of an agreement. Forgetting, of course, that they are under occupation. They have no authority. They have no sovereignty. And they have no way in which to govern and certainly aren't going to be willing to do terribly much so long as they are under occupation.
Thank you, Galia. I think you've provided a very strong overview and in some ways a challenge for us in terms of what it is that we, an implicit challenge for what it is that we must do to move forward from this point that may be a step forward but also involves some steps back. I want the first response to come from Dr. Shibli Talhami, who I would hope would take advantage of his expertise not only in Israel but in the region broadly to talk about this speech and also the important regional developments that we've seen in Lebanon and very dramatically in Iran Friday and over the weekend. Dr. Talhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland in College Park. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. In addition to his very strong academic credentials, he's been very active in the foreign policy arena here in Washington, D.C., going back to his days as an advisor to the U.S. mission at the U.N., as an aide to Congressman Lee Hamilton, who I remember very fondly as a chairman of the House International Relations Committee. He continues to be very active to this day. I won't go through his full CV, but very notably, he served on the Iraq Study Group, which made recommendations about how the U.S. should proceed in that just several years ago. And he is really an expert on public opinion across the Middle East. So with that, Dr. Talhami, I know we've asked you to speak about a lot, and I look forward to your comments.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure for me to speak to this organization that has been at the forefront of peace advocates, and I think you're to be commended, particularly to stay the course and under very difficult circumstances. And it's also always a pleasure to speak after my good friend Galia Juan, whom I have not seen in a while, but I look forward to an opportunity to see her soon. So I always enjoy hearing her analysis, and rarely do I disagree with it. Let me just say a couple of things about the Obama speech and then a couple of things about the regional picture. And obviously, we're going to have more questions and answers, and I know people would rather have that than hear a lecture here. So let me just give you a couple of more reactions on Netanyahu. I agree that, first of all, it was a step forward from before for Netanyahu to honor the two-state solution. I think in that sense it gives the president something to work with. I think you have to look at it, however, from two perspectives. One is how it's likely to play with American foreign policy of mediating an end to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in particular, and also how it's likely to play with the other side, mainly the Palestinians and the Arab states, who are particularly anxious to see an end to this conflict, including Egypt and Jordan. And the second is very easy to see. The Palestinian Authority, which has been looking for any excuse to say there's progress, I mean, they're not rejectionists by any means. In fact, they're under attack from Hamas and Palestinian public opinion for being too conciliatory. They have obviously reacted very rapidly and very negatively to the speech. So in that sense, they read this speech as not moving them forward and as being problematic to them. And they're reading the public opinion on this one. The Egyptians also were negative about important aspects of the speech. So in the regional picture, the speech certainly isn't well received. And I think in the Arab public opinion, obviously people will see it, will continue to see it in the media as an attempt to buy time to address the Obama administration's concern without moving forward. So that's the way it's being read in the region. The administration simply cannot afford to look at it that way. I think the administration's reaction has been, this is an important step, but there's a long way to go. I think that's a good attitude to take, because I think the president's assumption has to be that until such a time when progress is impossible, he has to assume the best about the intent. You can't assume that this is just an exercise in trying to delay. I think he has to assume that there is an intent to move forward and then to test it. And I think the administration should be testing this instead of just taking a completely negative position on the aspects that it doesn't like. And I think they're doing that. So I think from the diplomatic point of view, so far the reaction from the Obama administration, I think, is right. I think that's the way to do it. I should say my own read of the Obama administration on this. It's become obvious by now that the president himself and certainly the Secretary of State and the special envoy believe that, you know, peace between Israel and the Palestinians is an important national interest of the United States and that it's urgent to deal with it. He's put a lot into it already, and in some ways the administration's credibility is on the line. This has become, in essence, a global issue. It's one that he did in featuring, if he featured it in his important address to the Muslim world in Egypt. He has featured it in his conversations with world leaders. It is a part of his campaign to improve America's relations, not only with the Arab and Muslim world, but really with the international community and build relations with Europe. So the credibility of the administration is already on the line. And I think in the end, the credibility of the administration will be connected to the extent to which the president will move the Middle East closer to a two-state solution or away from a two-state solution. And so in that sense, I think the administration is serious and knows that it has to move forward. So whatever the meaning of the Netanyahu speech, it will be tested soon, because the administration is not going to get into this little detail of playing a indefinite process of negotiating little elements. I think they understand the urgency, and I think soon enough we'll know the extent to which the Netanyahu administration will be responsive. And the speech was not the most important test. It was something that the administration really has to see as a step and then put forth certain policy recommendations in order to test the extent to which the Netanyahu administration will be responsive. So I think that's where that is. Now, just very quickly on the Lebanese elections. Really not much has changed. I thought that the predictions that Hezbollah coalition was going to win were exaggerated from the beginning. I think it was a game of expectation in the sense that they, since they didn't achieve victory, they're seen to have lost. In reality, nothing has changed in Lebanon. More importantly, I think from the public opinion point of view in Lebanon, the opposition, including Hezbollah, received a majority of the votes in Lebanon. So don't forget that they have this beyond the argument about the the constitutional arrangement that limits the strengths of certain groups, they, in fact, in terms of total vote, the opposition still received more votes than the ruling coalition, obviously not the more parliamentary seats. So they have a claim still to public support. Public opinion polls that I have conducted in Lebanon before the election indicate they have, on important issues, they have the opposition has more support than the ruling coalition. And I think, importantly, Hezbollah still has, obviously, its military might that makes it a formidable player in Lebanese politics. So by and large, I think not much has changed in Lebanon. I think the picture remains roughly the same as it was. I wouldn't make any kind of major conclusions from the election. I think it hasn't really changed the picture much in Lebanon. Obviously, the domestic coalitions, how that will be formed, will be interesting. But on foreign policy, I don't think much will have changed. I think the same can be said about Iran. Obviously, there is evidence that there may have been cheating. We'll see how that goes. It's consequential for the Iranian people. The domestic coalitions would have been affected if Ahmadinejad lost. The international psychology would have been helped if Ahmadinejad had lost. I think it would have been a good thing, obviously, for everybody just to have him move from the scene, given the kind of position he's been taking and the kind of utterances he's been making. But in terms of the central issue between Iran and the international community, and particularly the U.S., the nuclear issue, you know, one cannot forget that there is almost unanimity in Iran about the basics of that issue. There is almost unanimity at the level of public opinion about the basics of that issue. There may be differences in style or the way it would be managed or the kind of relationship they want to have with the United States. But it's not clear that if Mousavi had won the elections, we would have had a different policy on the nuclear issue. And in that sense, I think, again, we're back to square one, roughly. I don't think that people some argue that Ahmadinejad is now empowered and therefore he's in a better position to be aggressive. I don't think so. I think that particularly now with the intensity of the opposition within that is taken to the streets. But more importantly, the overall pressure from the international community is not just from the U.S., given that the Obama administration has put forth a gesture to the Iranian government, Ahmadinejad has been slow to react to the gestures. The excuse was obviously the elections, wait and see what happens in the election. The election's now behind them. I think he's going to be under pressure to respond to the Obama administration. And so I see the administration, while it has to be concerned about what's happening internally in Iran, staying the course on the gestures and waiting to see what the Iranians will do. So I'll end with that and open it up.
Thank you, Dr. Tilhami. I am going to open the floor up now to questions.
This is Frank Bamberger. I have a question about the demand that those of us on the peace front make that all settlements be stopped. Does that mean, for example, that a third story in a house in Ariel can't be built? Is that something that's necessary in order to move forward?
No, I don't think the problem is a third story on a house. The point of this natural growth idea is that they take more land and use this as an excuse for building a house for their son or for their daughter. And it's recognized and acknowledged by everybody is more creeping expropriation. Nobody is objecting to a third floor. In other words, nobody is objecting to anything that doesn't mean moving and taking more territory. But the natural growth argument has been used as a justification for expanding the outer limits of settlements and creeping annexation. So that's really what's at issue. And the interesting thing is that the American government seems to be extremely aware of just this ploy. Nobody's bickering over details inside. It's very, very clear what is going on. There's a continuous effort to expand the areas that are going to be called these settlement blocks that are going to be accommodated, presumably by some kind of land swap and a final deal. This has been going on for a number of years now, expanding these settlement blocks, expanding settlements by putting up these outposts. And now, as I say, the excuse is that this is just to accommodate families. I don't think anybody really takes it seriously. The settlers themselves say it with a wink. They know exactly what's going on.
I should add, I don't know if you read Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer's op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday. If you haven't, you should read it, because it is a very important clarification of what had transpired between the Ariel Sharon government and the Bush administration, and where they stood on this issue of expansion, and whether or not there was an understanding. And I could tell you that in the past couple of weeks, I was part of an interview of high-level Bush administration officials. These were interviews on the record, but with that attribution, that included Kurtzer, Steve Spiegel, who's been active in Middle East peace efforts, and Bill Quant and Scott Lisinski. All of us are preparing a book on related issues. And this issue of settlement that Kurtzer talked about was brought up. And what he reflected in that view, in that article, was actually exactly what we heard from those high-level officials that we interviewed just in the past 2 weeks.
Thanks.
Thank you both for the question and for two helpful answers. If there's another question out there, please press *6.
I have a question. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you. My question is regarding AIPAC, there's an article in today's Haaretz saying U.S. Jewish leaders deeply troubled by Obama, and of course it references his talk in Egypt. Without AIPAC's support, does Obama's message have any meaning?
Go ahead, Carl. Yeah.
No, I certainly can't answer for the American scene or AIPAC, but I would like to make note of an article that was in Haaretz a few days ago, written by Yehuda Ben Meir, who was a former member of Knesset and actually came originally from the National Religious Party. And the title of it was something to the effect of "Don't Make an Enemy of Obama." And what he pointed out, in fact, was that one really should pay attention to some of the other things that Obama said in his speech. I mean, we tend to, certainly in Israel, to focus on various things that he said about the conflict. But one also should note the fact that in Cairo, he made one of the strongest statements ever made about the bond between the United States and Israel, and the loyalty of the United States to Israel's security and so forth. And I don't know, of course, how these things are being played out in the United States, but he made it very clear that hasn't changed. And I must say, as you know, that this has been a dispute for many, many years, where many of us in Israel feel that a pro-Israel policy, a policy that's in our interest, is not the policy that was being advocated by AIPAC, for that matter. And the policy that Obama has introduced is one which I certainly believe, and many people in Israel do believe, is in Israel's interests and is out of a deep concern, not only for changing America's image in the Middle East and improving America's position in the Middle East, but is also out of concern for the need to resolve this conflict, and resolution of this conflict can only be in Israel's interest.
You know, I should just say a couple of things about this. I mean, this is a president who is moving very rapidly on a lot of issues. And it's not just foreign policy. We look at the healthcare and the economy and all the issues that are important to Americans, and issues that are really controversial. I mean, we're not talking about ones that there's unanimity. That's why they've been avoided for so long, and he's tackling them head on. And to expect that there would be no opposition at all, or that you wouldn't have people from all walks of politics, from right and left, to be attacking him on those important decisions that he's making, I think is unrealistic. I think this is part of the American political process. You're going to have it. The important thing is those people who support him is to continue to support him. And there's I don't know whether AIPAC those people are quoted as, quote, speak for AIPAC. I mean, obviously, AIPAC rank and file is made up also of mainstream Jewish community with very divided views on this issue. And again, recall that 78% of American Jews voted for this president, despite all of the stuff that was done before. So I think we have to, instead of just accepting that as a fact and treating it as if it were highly significant in itself, I think we should put it in that bigger perspective, and also for those who support the policy that he's pursuing, just to accelerate and intensify the mobilization behind what he's doing.
Hi, this is Neil Rubin from the Baltimore Jewish Times.
Neil, if I could hold you off in one second,
sure.
I wanted to also throw in my two cents into that last answer, and I want to pick up on Shibley's point that I think was very important, and I think none of us here can speak for AIPAC or can be certain that AIPAC is really looking for a fight with the Obama administration. I have my doubts about that. There are two developments, though, if you want to look at where the American Jewish community is, that I think bear mentioning that have taken place over the last week or 10 days. One is the Central Conference of American Rabbis, which represents just under 2,000 Reform rabbis in the United States, issued a statement thanking the president for his very active role. And we saw today a similar statement released by the Religious Action Center. And if we remember that 60% of American Jews who identify with any of the Jewish religious streams identify with the Reform Movement, I think that we see that American Jews are speaking out in favor of the administration's engagement on this issue, on the peace process, and specifically on settlements. And the picture is more complicated, I would suggest, than any one sensational news story. And Neil, my apologies for cutting you off, and please ask your question.
I wanted to particularly ask Dr. Tilhami if the issue of Netanyahu's insistence on Arabs and Palestinians and other Arabs recognizing Israel as a Jewish state has any resonance in the Arab world, or if it's just seen as, oh, well, that's Netanyahu needs to do that to satisfy his base. And then, of course, I want to see if Dr. Golan can respond to that as well.
I think it's seen, across the board, it's seen as problematic demand. Now, it's interesting. I should say, if you look at it from some naming point of view, let's say if Israel were to call itself not Israel, but the Jewish state of Israel, just like Egypt calls itself the Arab Republic of Egypt, or Iran calls itself the Islamic Republic of Iran, and when people, or for that matter, even sometimes after a clan, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan or the the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, people will recognize the naming perfectly fine because they accept the state, and the state has a right to define itself, and you go along with that. The issue, of course, is when you're asking somebody to accept a principle or a legitimacy of a concept. We all have our own ways of legitimizing. It's perfectly fine for them. I respect people's religious beliefs, and many people will use their religious beliefs as grounds for legitimizing their political views. Fine. It's their way of looking at it. We have multiple sets of beliefs, and we can all respect each other. But in the end, that's not what, you know, the basis of demands on another to accept a certain kind of legitimacy. And so for the Arab side, particularly for the Palestinian side, it is such a difficult move, not because they can't accept a stable Jewish majority. I think that is something that has accommodated themselves, and most people understand that in the end, when the refugee issue is settled, the vast majority will not return to Israel, and Israel will still have a Jewish majority. It is the principle that if you define it that way, what are you doing to the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are the non-Jewish minority of Israel? That is, you know, now the non-Jewish majority, the non-Jewish minority is 25% of the population. 20% of them are Arabs, and so where do they stand in that picture? What are you saying about them when you're accepting that notion? So I think it's a very, very difficult one for people to accept in principle. I think the people accommodate themselves to a reality, and that's fine. They accept that, and they can accept the state as it is, as it defines itself. And I said if that was the name of Israel, the Jewish state of Israel, and so when they're recognized, send a letter, the Jewish state of Israel, just like you say the Arab Republic of Egypt and so forth. But I think it's as a demand to expect that to happen up front is something that is improbable.
I think that if I may comment on that, I think that's giving us the benefit of the doubt, Shibley. I think that in many ways this is simply viewed as adding still another condition. I mean, legitimacy is indeed the heart of the issue for Jews. There's no question about it. And originally what Israel wanted was to be recognized, plain and simple, and that was something that was, of course, refused. So the first demand was that it be recognized. And so, okay, came recognition, and then the argument was, well, no, we want recognition of the right of Israel to exist. And we got that. That's what Arafat gave in the Oslo Accords, was the recognized Israel's right to exist. It's basically also what's in the peace agreement with Egypt and the peace agreement with Jordan. And now we come along with a new thing. It's not enough to recognize our right to exist. And the right to exist, of course, is the heart of the issue. Do we have a right to be here? Not just a question of recognizing or acknowledging a fact that Israel exists, but recognizing, accepting the fact that Israel has a right to be here. And that was given. Now, there was, by the way, also another addition along the way, which fortunately I think has dropped a bit, and that was the demand of the democracy, that is, that the Palestinian state be a democratic state. We're going to have to wait until it was a democratic state before they could happen. But in any case, what it looks like very much is now there's this added demand, which Netanyahu had brought up long before, many years ago, of recognizing not only Israel's right to exist, but Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. And then you get the problems that Shibley mentioned, of course, because there are Arab citizens here, and so what does this exactly mean? Now, we know that we're a state for the Jewish people. This was the way in which Ben-Gurion presented it. The Resolution 181 talks about an Arab state in Palestine and a Jewish state in Palestine. We know that technically you can say it, and certainly as a Zionist I believe that we as Jews have a right to self-determination and this is our state. But there's no question that bringing it up now, adds a condition which we didn't demand of any of Egypt or of Jordan, and B, is a complicating condition because we have, of course, the Arab minority here and making this a very, very difficult thing. And usually, by the way, the answer that I hear from Palestinians is that the nature of your state can be whatever you want. It's not for the Palestinians or anybody else to tell us what what the nature of our state should be. I, for one, also don't think we need their approval or their recognition. even of our right to exist. But okay, legitimacy is a serious problem. Sadat gave us just that over and over again in his speech to the Knesset, and the Egyptians gave it in the peace agreement, the Jordanians gave it, and Arafat gave it. I must admit that I look upon this as the addition of another condition, and one of many, unfortunately. It's, of course, one that's very hard for an Israeli Jew to argue against, but I think we ought to see it for what it is, because I don't think that it really changes anything. We need a peace agreement with the Palestinians. They have already abandoned their claim to all of Palestine. They have already made their compromise of a two-state solution and limiting their demands to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They have already recognized Israel's right to exist within peace and security. I think that I don't think we have the need for still more demands.
This is Gil Keeley. Could I ask a question?
Sure. Let me say we're running short on time, so I'd like to take two questions at once and then ask our both of our guests to respond to all the questions and any closing thoughts that they have.
I have another question. This is Jacqueline Ford.
Okay, well, let's take those two questions.
Okay. Galia Shibley, hi. Good to hear from you. It's pretty obvious to anyone that given Netanyahu's current coalition configuration, there's no way that he is going to be able to agree to any realistic terms for a settlement. But given the outside possibility that he might conclude himself that he's prepared to at least talk seriously about this with the U.S. and with the Palestinians, and this is principally a question for Galia, what do you think is the possibility or the likelihood that he would reconfigure his coalition by dropping Lieberman and the other parties to the right and turn to Kadima to form a coalition?
This is very much
Galia,
in the air.
Excuse me, Galia. Let me have you hold
Thank
on that
question.
While we get the second
sure.
question.
Okay.
This is Jacqueline Swartz from Toronto. Hi. My question is, to what extent has both Obama's statement and also the sort of recognition that there is an alternative to the hardliners in AIPAC, and there is a sort of pro-peace constituency in the United States, to what extent has all this emboldened the peace movement in Israel?
Okay. Well, first of all, just to quickly answer the question about the coalition. Certainly, the air has been buzzing for the past week about the talks that have been taking place between Likud and Kadima. And there was a lot of talk that it might actually happen. There might be this switch before the speech, and the speech would be the dramatic change. I think the bottom line is the general expectation is that if Netanyahu is willing really to go forward, that is to make some kind of genuine move towards peace, and it is generally assumed that this would only be the result of American urging, we could put it that way, then yes, the answer is to maintain his government by bringing in Kadima. And I think that's a very realistic possibility. If and when we reach such a point, certainly there can be a stable government created without these extreme right-wing elements by bringing in Likud, and Labor is already there. So it certainly can be done, and the general sense is that it would be done if, and that's the big if, and that if of Netanyahu's making a genuine step forward, I think is going to depend, I would say 90%, even 95%, on what comes out of Washington.
Hmm.
The second question about the peace camp. Well, I can tell you one thing. There's a tremendous thrill in Israel to Obama, and particularly amongst the young people. The slogans, everything we hear from the young people, it's say yes to Obama. And it's actually a very good way of putting it in Hebrew and then combining it with the English. There is a tremendous sense here that Obama has presented something very new and very exciting. He has captured people's imagination, which is, by the way, one of the reasons that the right wing is now focusing on Obama and these pictures of Obama dressed up with a keffiyeh looking something like Arafat. They're zeroing in because Obama is so popular here, and I think that there's been tremendous encouragement that there's something to work with here, that we've got one of the most right-wing governments we've ever had in Israel. It's a seriously problematic government, and at the same time, there's a tremendous opportunity out there because not only because of Obama's personality, but because the understanding here, in any case, is that he's serious, about going ahead, that he knows this issue, that the people around him know this issue, and that they aren't going to fall prey to bluffs, to subterfuge, that they know what the score is and that they won't put up with nonsense. That's the sense here. Now, I hope we're right. I mean, I hope that this is an accurate view of the administration in Washington. But certainly at the moment there's tremendous hope, particularly, as I say, among the young people in the peace camp.
Let me just say something about the first question. I'll leave the second question to Galia, since she's reading the sentiment in Israel better than I am. But on the Netanyahu government, obviously one of the difficulty for him is to use his government coalition as an excuse in terms of not being responsive to the Obama administration. And the reason for that is because it's seen as a government of choice, not a government of necessity. And you know, people are very understanding of democratic politics, but it's a government of choice, not a government of necessity. It's very difficult to make the case. And I think in that sense, yes, I think clearly it would be significantly helped if the government broadened in his talks with everyone else, you know, or the way he can frame it or even use the coalition. If you wanted to use it as an argument. But from the Obama administration's point of view, while every American government always has an interest in the type of government it's dealing with, whether it's in Israel and Arab countries or elsewhere, and has preferences, given the timetable, this administration wants to move rapidly. It wants to make progress. It's not just make a progress. It wants to end the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on its watch if it could. And if that's the case, you just simply cannot make a policy based on strictly engineering the kind of coalition or government or election that's going to happen in Israel. You just have to deal with whatever there is, and you have an Israeli government, you deal with it, and you formulate your policy accordingly, and you see where that takes you. And so I don't think the primary objective of American foreign policy can be awaiting such time as you have the right coalition, because I think that is not something that we can engineer. It's not something we haven't done it well in the Palestinian case. We haven't done it well in other cases, and I think we're unlikely to succeed in the Israel case. Now, that doesn't mean that the Israeli public in and of itself will not be responsive to the nature of the relationship as it emerges between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu government. Obviously, it's a dynamic game, and we know the Israeli public is responsive, but I think it can't be the central feature of a strategy of the Obama administration in pushing forward for progress in the peace process.
I want to thank both Dr. Rolland and Dr. Telhami for their time today and for their reflections and thoughts.